All right, folks, welcome. I think we're about to get started. Just maybe in a minute for a couple of people coming in. All right, welcome, folks. My name is Jack Cabat. I'm a lead program manager in the information protection team. For those of you who attended the keynote, I'm part of Christian's organization, and we're an organization across office working on a lot of the compliance features like DLP, like policy management, auditing, archiving, e-discovery. And I'm specifically responsible and my team for the data loss prevention capabilities that you've seen in both Exchange 2013 and the new additions we've done for SP1 and the work we're taking on forward. So this is an advanced data loss prevention session. It's a continuation of some of the earlier session we had yesterday, which was more of an introduction session to give you a feel of what some of the experiences are. What I want to focus on with you today is specifically looking at more behind the scenes of how do you actually achieve and configure the system and customize it in a way to meet your needs. You've seen a lot of cool demos, interesting end-user experiences. This session is really taking things look behind the curtain to see how things are configured and how can you customize this to really meet your needs from a flexibility perspective and from a functional perspective. So just by show of hands, how many of you had a chance to see the overview session or are familiar with our DLP? Great, that's most folks. For the rest of you, I'll have a little bit of an intro in terms of kind of how the functionality works, but then we'll kind of dive in deeper and talk about customizations. We'll go into the classification engine, look at some of the XML configurations of being able to tune our rules and being able to also create your own sensitive types that you can then feed into the system. And look at a system from a policy perspective and also customizations for the end user. So outside of that, how many of you are actually also are familiar with DLP and either have an existing installation of DLP in your organization? This could be our solution or any of the other vendors' solution out in the marketplace. Great. So keep your hands up. And how many of you are actually looking or using our capabilities? Okay. Awesome. All right. So just to start off, this is kind of our traditional intro slide to data loss prevention. It really kind of puts more of a common framework in terms of how we think about it. So data loss prevention for us is really around helping to identify, monitor, and protect sensitive data through deep content analysis. And so a lot of words, but the identify, monitor, and protect are specifically the ones to focus on. Identification is all about being able to find both the right content from a sensitive content perspective, but also to identify that from a contextual. So who's doing the operation? Are they sending it externally, internally? Is this between groups? All of those aspects is what we think of as falling into identification. Protection is about being able to, once you've identified the data, to set a set of policies that really are a response to what we've been able to discover. So from a policy perspective, it's really the policy response or policy actions that map to the conditions that you've identified. Monitoring then falls into being able to get a view into the system in terms of how your policies are functioning, what kind of detections you're having in this system. And also, we provide that both from a reporting perspective, but also from a real-time notification. When something's happening in real time, there's ability for you to get notification at that point. And then finally, end user education. That's one of our differentiators in terms of being able to bring the end user into the fold and be able to have the end user participate in the compliance policy of the organization. So it's really around empowering the end user with potentially overrides and educating them in terms of what are the sensitive types in the system. So with that in mind, kind of that level setting, I'll do a very quick demo to just so our kind of intro demo of what do you get out of the box from a DLP perspective. All right, so Here, most of you also have seen from the keynote is while we also have the Unified Compliance Console, I'm actually logging in right from Exchange Admin Center into our compliance management slab and looking into data loss prevention. So the first thing I'm going to do is create a new policy from template. And again, what we have here is about 40 or so policy templates that are from around the globe. And all a policy template really is a grouping of policy objectives in a single unit that can be then managed throughout the system. So I'm going to go ahead and select, let's see, how about Japan financial data? And before I create this, I'm going to create my policy in a disabled state since we're going to be editing that in a minute. So what this is going to do is take this policy template, figure out all the rules that are applicable as part of it, and instantiate the rules within the system itself. So the rules that we're using are based on exchange transport rules, and we're basically extending those and modified that to built in the DLP capability right into that. And the reason for that is to enable a very diverse policy capabilities. Our transport rules have over 50 different conditions and about 20 different actions. And you get to mix and match these to really be able to create policies that are targeted to your environment. And the policy templates that we have created really focus on stuff that's around the globe that's globally identifiable. So either regulations or categories of content around the globe that can be well described. So after creating our policy template, this creates a policy within our view. And if I look into this, there's really two main areas. One is a general description of what the policy is. You can enable disabled its state and control its mode, and I'll go into that later. But more interestingly, the policy has created five transport rules as part of its instantiation. And our model is very similar across the various policies, where we'll create five transport rules that have a similar similar categories as this, but they're customized to what sensitive types they're looking for. And if we look at this, these are quite simple. We have one that focuses on low count, one on high count, and what this does is looks for content going outside the organization that has Japan credit card and Japan bank account number and credit card, and it will apply a set of policies for the min count. For the min rule, we focus between 1 and 9, and the high count will focus on anything above. In this rule, we will notify the sender. This is how we actually enable the communication with the end user. This is our hook into educating the end user and being able to provide various interactions from notification to justifications to blocking. Again, quite a bit of things you can configure here. I'm going through this a little faster just to give people more of a context setting and get to the more detailed sections coming up. So quickly looking at the high count rule, again, very similar. The only difference really is the fact that A, we're looking for entity counts above 10, and our actions are a little different here. We'll actually block the message and then allow user to override it before it's sent out. The other rules that are created, one is to basically look for content that has not been fully scanned. So we will scan content. It's possible the content's larger than what we will scan out of by default. And we want to be able to allow you to create a policy to say, well, I want to examine all the content. You weren't able to do this, then do something with this message. And then you can use any of the transport rule actions to deal with that. The last one is around attachment not supported. And this is really to deal with, again, cases where the content is not understood by our system. So, for example, we don't have an iFilter to text extract from the type you've included. And this will trigger this rule. And again, you get to decide what to do as a remediation. Or in the default case, all we will do is just log the actual event that it occurred. So that's kind of very quickly looking at what the default capabilities are. And a lot of our demos actually, it's sufficient to get them going because I can now go ahead and switch personas. I'm now the information worker, the end user. Here I have actually, I'm logged in as Sarah. I'm going to go ahead and compose an email. In this case, it's going to be to myself outside of the organization. The organization Sarah is in is Contoso Exports. I'm going to attach a file, in this case, one that has credit card numbers. And as I'm interacting with the Outlook client, in the background, we're doing the classification scan and evaluation of policy. In this case, we triggered the policy for an override. So if the user was to send the message, they will actually be blocked. And then what they can do, however, is provide an override justification. To still go ahead and perform the operation. And we'll just send that off to Jack. And it's as simple as that. And that was all accomplished by having our default policy enabled in the system, really kind of just out of the box. The one thing I should point out is the policy that you will see trigger later is actually not the one I just created in Japan. And the reason is there's a little bit of a delay as we instantiate the rules for them to be propagated through the system. There's about a 15-minute delay from the time you instantiate some of the rules to see them in real time. And that would make a great demo. Anyway, so going back to our slide deck. So that was kind of what you get out of the box to get started. And it's really meant to be a set of starting points, a starting points for you to start your customizations. So what we're going to do here, though, however, is actually start focusing on what are the customization points available in the system. And customizations are things that we have built in from the beginning. These are not add-ons. And as you can see, throughout how we think of DLP, throughout the four pillars, each one of them has customizations built into it. And we'll dive through most of these in the session today. So when we think of identification, the customization points are around sensitive contents, around ability to tune built-in types, and an ability to create your own sensitive types. And we'll dive in deeper of how to do that in this session. You can also create custom policy templates. And policy templates and sensitive types are a little bit different. Policy templates operate at a higher level, where it's more about the objectives of what your policy is to do and the kind of actions and conditions you want to be able to find it. Sensitive types are very specific to what is the sensitive data in the system that you want to be able to detect. Next, under protection, there's really two things. One is a very flexible policy authoring system. And this is, again, where transport rules come in, where you can do a lot of customizations just by clicking a set of UI wizards and don't have to actually get very deep in the system to have a very flexible set of policies customized to what your needs are. And then the next thing is the rich policy conditions and actions that are included in that system. We have over 50 different conditions, from looking up Active Directory attributes to various aspects of the recipients, senders, their managers, and ability to direct on domains or mail flow. All of those things are built in, available to you to get started with. And then similarly for actions, there's 20 plus actions to enable you to customize the look and feel that you need. From a monitoring perspective, there's three main things. One is real-time incidents, and that's something you can configure in terms of what data and what thresholds you have to actually generate an incident. You decide where that goes, and that can be going for to an, more of an auditor or more of a compliance officer or somebody who's actually tuning the system. And you have a lot of flexibility of what the endpoint of that is. The next is policy rule reporting, and there's two aspects of this. One, our reporting data, our audit data, is embedded right into message tracking log. So if you have something that already consumes message tracking log, that data can easily be integrated into that system. And second aspect of that is the ability that we have actually in Office 365 provided a set of reporting capabilities. And those are available for you and built on top of the policy and transport rules capabilities that are built in and are using the same message tracking data content as available in our raw logs. And finally, the policy audit mode. That's something else that's quite handy. It's a small feature, but it will really make a difference in your deployments in terms of being able to set up your policies the way you expect them to be acting, and then put them in audit mode so you can actually see what they would do if they were actually enabled. And that's, again, putting the end user first, understanding what the impact of your deployment is before you actually have unhappy users on your hand. From end user education, we also have a couple extensibility points, and those deal with how do I actually customize the end user experience from both the text that's presented to them to things like end users being able to do false positive reporting to help you tune the system to see what kind of sensitive data you are actually dealing with. All right, so it's worth just stepping aside for a second and talk about DLP deployment phases. And these are pretty straightforward: plan, tune, enable. And we've touched on them in various sessions in the past, but it's good just to kind of review them and also connect them to the extensibility points, because a lot of the extensibility and customization points actually map into how we expect and see some of our customers deploying the capability in the organization. So from a plan perspective, and I should mention, this is really from the phase of you deploying the capability. There's a lot of work you're likely needing to do to decide what are the right regulations for me to target my DLP capability for. What are some of the sensitive types those regulations deal with? This is where our policy templates can help, but again, it's something for you to decide and make sure you're covering all the sensitive types that are required by your organization. So the planning stage really starts off with seeing what built-in type closely relates to what you're trying to do, so which policy template meets your business or regulatory requirements the closest, and starting from that point. Then you go ahead and customize these policy rules, sensitive types, and scopes to see how can I actually target the right users in the organization, the right contextual interaction of the policy. And then finally, we usually recommend having more of a target pilot group of users to target your policies for, get a little bit more familiar of how this works in your organization. One of the things that I always hear from customers is most folks don't actually think there's much sensitive data flowing in the organization. And they go ahead and deploy a solution like this, partially because somebody else is forcing them to do so, maybe the legal department. And they're usually surprised about the kind of data to learn that's flowing through their organization. Not necessarily a happy surprise, but good to know, and then at least a start of how to actually protect yourself and your organization moving forward. The next phase is tuning, and tuning is really around, while here it's a sequential, it's really something that you will continue to do in the system over time, partially because the data in your organization, the business processes will continue to evolve, and you want to make sure that your solution is tailored to what that is. So the tuning phase focuses on being able to set the policies in audit mode and really observe of how they would interact, being able to use your incident report capabilities to get real-time notifications of seeing what is the sensitive content being detected, are users providing a lot of false positives, are users doing a lot of overrides, and then using our reporting capability to track some of these rates. This is, again, how some of the tools you have available in the product to help you with the tuning phase. And finally, enabling. This is really switching the policies to an on mode where all the actions, no matter how destructive they are from a modification of the mail flow, will be enabled. And again, as part of enabling, tuning continues to be able to look at more of the reporting data and trends to see, do you have business processes that are changing that you need to then retune for? Does that make sense? Any questions on this? All right, so quickly going through policy templates. You've seen these before on some of the intro sessions, but really think of them as this is more of a management capability within our system, where we want to bring in a set of rules that make up a policy and then enable you a single method how to manage them, a consistent method. So your policies will likely target either a set of regulations, potentially a set of departments. You can think of them as however your organization manages, what is the right management block in your organization? And again, we have starting points, but from an extensibility perspective, these are things that can also be provided by third-party vendors and imported into your system, and you can also build your own policy templates. So, talk a lot about them, but what are they? Well, they're fundamentally an XML definition that has a set of meta properties, things like name, description, versions, and then the actual policy objectives, and those are represented as transport rules. And they're actually even using the representation of what a transport rule would look like on the command line, which means you can actually author these yourself quite easily with the, there's a little bit of token substitution to provide data input as part of the creation process and localize them to the content that your users are most familiar with. Once you import these, though, they really become policies within the system, and you manage the policy as a management unit within that. And we can look at one of these in more details of what these look like, but the same schema that we use is available externally for you guys to use as well. All right, so inside of these policy, once you've instantiated one of these policy templates, you will create DLP policy rules. And DLP policy rules are, again, something built on top of transport rules. What that means is, just like transport rules, the rules are processed in a sequential order. So if I have 50 rules, I will process my rules in a running order. The rules really work on defining a set of conditions, and you can have as many as you like. The conditions are ended, so think of them almost as filters. So if I have a condition of the recipient is outside the organization and having credit cards, both of those things have to be true for the rule to hit. And then the rule has a number of actions. And actions here can be one or many. Some actions are terminating. What that means is once the action executes, no more rules are processed. An example of this would be things like generation of an NDR or creation or an action that's called stop rule processing, which actually instructs the system to stop processing additional rules in the system. The actions can range really from end user notifications all the way through kind of hard changes to mail flow, such as blocking, NDRing, and anything in the middle, encryption, moderation, etc. And finally, you also have exceptions. Exceptions are the other part of the rule, and they're quite powerful for you to configure, just like conditions, what are the set of exceptions that this rule shouldn't apply in. And the conditions used in exceptions are the same you can use in the initial conditions. So you have, again, a very flexible ability to create exceptions for these in your system. All right, so we're going to go through our next demo, which focuses on customizations of these policy templates. So we're going to go back to our Japan financial data policy, and we're going to start doing a little bit of editing to this. All right, so go to our rules, and I'm going to focus really on the two rules, low count and high count. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to scope this to a subset of our organization. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to add another condition. And basically, this is the sender is a member of this group, and I already have a group called pilot, which are my set of pilot users I'm going to deploy this capability to. No. So this is going to basically scope the rule that only if one of the users who I've decided to add into my pilot group will this ever apply. And that's, again, a very useful capability as you get started to just understand and have better control of who you're sending this to or who you're applying the policies to. I'm going to do the same thing for the other rule. All right, so we have pilot users. Well, the other thing that would be useful is to also configure our exceptions. And even if your exception group is something that's maybe you don't have any users in the exception group yet, it's actually a good idea to configure your policies and rules with a group for exceptions, and then you can populate the users as you need into that group and not need to reauthor your policies. So we're going to do just that. So we're going to go back again to our rules, low count, and we're going to add an exception. Add exception, and we're going to use the same model of identifying the senders from a specific group. And here we're going to use our LCA group. Interestingly, they've asked us to implement this policy, but they've also asked to be excluded from the policy themselves. And you can kind of see a pattern that some of these things that I want to affect across the policy, you will have to do across number of rules for them to apply consistently. So I'm going to do exactly the same thing to my high count rule, where basically I'm going to, again, sender is a member of this group, and here we're going to have legal. All right, pretty straightforward, but what I've done already is scoped something that was organization-wide to be very, very specific. And I've used, you know, groups to scope this, but there's really many other mechanisms to scope and do exactly what I did with just a couple clicks. Maybe your users are within a specific department, and that department is identified by a setting in Active Directory. Easily you can configure that through the same clicks I just did to perform the same scoping of the policy. All right, so the next thing we're going to do is add this action called Generate Incident Report. And I've talked a little bit about it, and you've seen it in potentially some demos. So what this will do is we'll generate an action, and we're going to select an endpoint to receive this. I already have something called an incident mailbox that I'm going to configure. And then you get to decide what kind of content do you want to be included in this notification. This is interesting because you may have a different set of users who you're going to target this to. You may have more of compliance officers that should see everything, including the original message content that was hit. And you may have somebody else who's less privileged, who or even a workflow system that should kick off some actions based on the content here. So I'm going to select sender, recipient, subject, and a bunch of things around what kind of rules were hit. Was it a false positive? Did the user override the content? And what kind of data classifications were detected? Basic building blocks for us to start and be able to tune what kind of hits are we seeing in the system. All right, so this is going to save, and we're going to do exactly the same thing to our high count rule. And clearly, you can actually have a different endpoint for your configuration based on the severity. So here we're looking for high counts. It may be very easy for you to, and something you need to do, to configure a different endpoint for receiving these notifications, since the threshold for hitting off from this rule is much higher. All right, and again, so this will provide a real-time notification at the time when the rules are hit. So that's kind of, you know, nice, getting a little bit more detail. But besides, you know, notifications, we'd want to do something a little bit more proactive in the system once we detect sensitive data. So what we're going to do is add additional rules that will do more of an encryption when sensitive content is detected. And I'm going to start off by content that's sent to our partner, where we're going to actually use TLS encryption, since we already know. So here, the message is sent to a different domain. The domain is Contoso Parts. And additional condition is we're going to add that it has sensitive information. Again, similar things to what was configured in our initial rules. So here we're going to add credit card number. We're going to add Japan. Bank account number. And given this is the rule we're configuring, we're going to readjust the min and max counts to match our rule. Again, relatively straightforward, and all of this. So what we're seeing here is, for this rule that's being sent to Contoso Parts, which is our partner, we're going to and that contains sensitive data. What we're going to do is actually do protect the message. And we're going to require TLS encryption to this partner. The other thing we're going to do is also play with this severity mode, and I'll show you how this fits into reporting. And we're going to basically tag any hits of this rule with severity medium, which then will tie into our reporting capabilities. And actually, the other thing we should add to this rule is an action called stop rule processing, which means if we're already going to encrypt the TLS, there's no point in doing more rules. So here, actually, so we scroll down, there's an option to stop processing more rules. And again, so now we've added ability to, if this is being sent to our partner, enforce the fact that it has TLS connection to their system. Well, we might as well go further than that and also add additional rule for message sent out externally. And for this, we're going to look for a recipient. Who's located outside our organization. And for this, we're going to protect the message. And we're going to apply our OME encryption, Office 365 encryption. And again, this is a capability, if you haven't been to the encryption show talk, it's a new capability we've added recently to enable encryption outside of, with your partners outside of your organization. And here we're also going to modify this to do medium audit. Anyway, so with this simple configurations, what we've now created is a scoped set of rules, added some exceptions, enabled TLS encryption, and also created encryption for other content sent externally that has sensitive data. I skipped the step of actually including the sensitive data just so that we can move this a little faster, but it's exactly the same step as I did in the previous rule. All right, so this is our now modified policy. One of the things is we've talked a little bit about the GIR of this action to do real-time notifications, and I wanted to give you a quick look of what that actually looks like. So I'm going back to Sarah here, and I'm going to create another message to Jack. I'm going to attach a document that has some credit card numbers. And this we need to override, so yes. Before quarter end, we're going to send this out. And as I said, this Outlook view, I'm sharing both with Sarah, but on the bottom I also have my incident management system, where it's the mailbox that's the recipient of all the real-time notifications. And what I've done is, I've created some very simple search folders that I can quickly identify, for example, the false positives. And that's purely by looking at the content in the messages and being able to see which of this content is false positive. Similarly, I can see overrides, And here is the new message I just overrode that shows up in this folder. And again, this is something, a very easy capability for you to tune and see how many users are reporting false positive, how many users are reporting overrides, and then you can focus on these things from a tuning perspective in your system. And in terms of just what these things look like, I have ones here that have been configured that have minimal data. And it's really, aside from the header messages, we see the data classifications. We found a credit card. There was 28 of them. And we also found that the rule hit was Australian PII data. And as part of a policy, Australia personality identifiable information. And then here are the actual actions that were carried out as part of the policy. That's the abbreviated look. Here is more of a fuller report. And what this focuses on, it also includes what was the actual content in the messages that was triggered. Again, you get to tune what's in here depending on what the audience of this is. But clearly, having the content is pretty pivotal in terms of being able to tune and have someone look at, are these really true false positives? All right, any questions on incident reports? So before I move on from kind of my policy editing, is there anything else that you guys are interested in terms of what are some of the common policy configurations that you would see required or useful within your organization? Sure, so we'll add fingerprints to the policy in the next stage. Anything else from kind of organization or organizational division of how you would see applying DLP, where you're creating policies for different departments or anything of that nature? Sure, so if you wanted to quarantine, that's actually, you would do that through selecting one of the actions in the message itself. So we'd go to one of our rules. Let's assume attachment not supported. And you can select the quarantine action from the available list of actions in the rule. I think this would be under host to quarantine. Will be an action of how you could actually put this in a quarantine and then use our quarantine system to be able to then look at this and manage it through that. Anything else? Yes, you can. So moderation is so the question was, can you also send this to moderator? So yes, moderation is one of the built-in transport rule capabilities, and you can set up a moderation mailbox and a set of approvers and then target the messages into that. And that's very much used for some of the corner case scenarios where you wouldn't necessarily want to moderate every message that's caught, but as part of your auditing or even fine-tuning, that's a great way to do that. So what you would really need to do is configure your policies in a way where if it's coming from one of the moderators, you'd probably put them in a different moderation mailbox. So you'd basically use the flexibility of the configuration to exclude the moderators from the moderation rule themselves and potentially have them on a different moderation rule where they're not the approvers of the messages. Yes? So from a client perspective, so most of these rules are executed server-side, so executed transport rules inside of Categorizer. The only client capability here is when we're actually looking at the policy tips. So this is how you could, this is how we control our client action. And this is how you could do this. Now, one of the capabilities you could do, especially for on-prem installations, is have us classify the message, set a header on that message, and you can actually have your own agent that will do additional processing on the classifications that we've set because that message will be passed on to you as a set of detections. Sir? Oh, yes. Yes, and other folks, please try to use the mics if I forget. I'll take two more.
Can you
So the question is, can you use the policy tip action when the condition is something else than sensitive data? And today, that is not the case. We limit that or tie it into the detection of sensitive types. But it's something that I'd love to hear from you maybe after the session of what other requirements and areas would you see that being applicable. So very much something we're interested in getting feedback on. Sorry, one more question. I'm sorry? So the policy configurations are actually distributed. Outlook will pull these policies from Exchange and have those be configured. So there is no additional client-level configuration required. This will be pulled right into your Outlook client. So the question is, how does policy tips work in Outlook, given we haven't sent this to the server yet? And the reason is because we've actually built in our classification engine and policy engine right into the client, into the Outlook client. So it's detecting and running the same scans that are done on the server in the client itself. So the classification engine is actually embedded inside of Outlook, and so is a policy engine that understands the same constructs. The actual scanning is happening on the client side, yes. So it happens in the case of policy tips for things like Outlook 2013, it happens in two places. It happens on the client, and it always happens on the server. So you have two levels of validations and two levels of enforcement. So last question, and I'll move on with the session. So in OWA, it's a little bit different model, obviously. So the question was, how does it work in the OWA case? And obviously, the model is different because it's thin clients. So there is a communication between the client, and we do it on the back end, where we're actually calculating the rules and evaluating them at the back end of the OWA in AWS and provide the messages back and forth as part of the interaction of the client application. So again, the model has to fit of what client capabilities are available. Correct. So the question was, which versions of Outlook would see the policy tips? And it's Outlook 2013 forward. All right, so we'll continue. Great questions. We'll continue with the rest of the session. And for you that we don't have, if we won't get to all your questions, we actually, right after this, we have a session, to just a Q&A session, the unplugged around DLP. So please come to that as well. So quick view of incident reports. We've covered this quite a bit. You get to see the audit data. You get to see what classifications have been actually hit. And then you see the rule details, the actual transport rules that have caused this. And then you can also see what are the actual content in the mails that have contributed to the match. All of these things, as we covered, are configurable. And you get to decide what you see. All right. So. Switching gears a little bit and thinking now about classification and customizations at the classification level. So first, just a quick recap in terms of our content analysis process. It's kind of a slide you've probably seen before, but in high level, just to go through this quickly, our content analysis is more than just our regex matching. It starts off with regex matching, but then you have a list of heuristics available to you to ensure you've actually match the right content. So in case of a credit card, that's a checksum validation on top of that, in addition, followed by a number of corroborative evidences. For things that don't have a lot of built-in validation into it, things like employee IDs or other things, driver's licenses, you would rely more on the corroborative evidences in addition to matching the actual pattern. And in that case, you may actually need to tune your content a little bit of what you're matching that takes into account what mail flow is you have in your organization. So for example, at Microsoft, one of the things that we've found out is our product bug numbers seem to have matched some of the driver's license definitions. and we need to tune some of the rules to exclude. But that's, again, would be an example of something unique to our organization where, obviously, product numbers are not something that's very unique outside of Microsoft. All right. So looking at sensitive content type customizations, what are the capabilities available here? Well, the first thing is something we've already covered earlier in the session is from a policy perspective. And this is where you get to just very easily configure how many counts of the sensitive types you have encountered and provide the right response to that. The next level is around tuning, and this is where you actually will get into the custom classification itself and potentially provide additional corroborative evidence that needs to be satisfied or potentially excluded from being matched for you to reduce the false positives. And then we also offer the ability to configure different confidences for the patterns. You'll see this later, but what this really allows you to do is for types that are very much relying on a lot of corroborative evidence, you may have levels of matching where if I've matched, you know, this two types of corroborative evidence, I will feel pretty good that this is the right thing. But if I have the additional corroborative evidence matched as well, then I will have a much higher confidence. And then how you could use that is provide a different policy response based on how confident you are feeling that you've actually matched the intended entity. And finally, being able to define your own custom sensitive types is very much something that's available in the system. Once you've defined these will be used in the system as the built-in ones. So these sensitive types, what do these really look like? Well, fundamentally, it's an XML file that provides the definition of the heuristics used to match it. And it starts off with a number of, we call these rule packs. It's a rule pack XML file or a rule collection. And that file has a set of metadata around the description, the publisher, and then you get into the definition of what is the specific regexes, what are potential functions, what are the potential corroborative evidences that are required, excluded, what is the proximity of them within the content, and that's all within the XML itself. So let's see what that looks like. All right, so exit from my previous demo here. Ah, thank you. All right. So we're going to start looking at this. And what I'm looking at here is actually the XML for the out-of-the-box rule pack. And this is actually for the rule pack that defines the 51-plus classifications that we ship in the box. That content of this file is available to all of you. If you have the system, you can actually get the rule pack, serialize it, and this is what you'll get. And I'll use this to just walk you through what this looks like. So you have a rule pack ID. Because this is our Ub rule pack, it uses the very creative GUID of zeros. And then after that, we have a number of content that describes what this rule pack looks like, where it's who's the publisher, what the description is, and as you can see, we provide various locales for you to localize this in, again, for the various users who would be interacting with the system. Well, let's get to the interesting stuff. So after that, we get into the rule definitions. And our first rule definition is our canonical credit card number definition. So these are what's called entity rules. Entity rules are basically rules that will anchor on a specific value, such as a regex, and then you will build corroborative evidences around it as needed. So in this case, we assign this a GUID. So the schema here uses a reference model where there's a definition of for this ID in terms of other properties. But from a rule perspective, you see that the pattern proximity is 300 for this rule, which means we will look for within 300 characters of the anchor element for additional data to corroborate the existence of this rule. Our confidence for this rule is set for 85. We will call something called a function for credit card, which is a built-in capability in the engine to detect credit cards and do the checksum validation. And then we will also want to find one of the following things. There's a set of keyword matches for verification, keyword matches for name, and the function that detects dates. So these are the three things we want to have, or one of those three things we need to have in addition to the credit card number to match this rule and return a confidence of 85. So this is pretty straightforward. So let's look at one that's a little bit more interesting. So just going a little bit lower in the file, it's Australian file tax number. This is, again, one of our built-in types. And you can see the format is pretty similar, where we start off with the entity definition and the proximity. But here, the next aspect is we have actually two patterns, pattern one, pattern two, with different confidences. And this is what I was talking about before, where for this entity, because it's less structured and has less validation data built into it, we may actually have multiple definitions of how we try to match it, and then be able to provide different confidences on our matches. So in the first definition, our confidence level is 85. And the numbers themselves don't actually mean that much. It's more of what you're going to reference them within policies. So think of them as a set of integers from, you know, from 0 to 100. But 85, 86, there isn't really a huge delta. It's just purely a configuration parameter. So here we will first match an Australian tax file number through a regex. And this is kind of, again, our anchor of where we start looking. Then we'll use the proximity window of 300 characters to find, in this case, actually make sure we don't have any of these two things: keyword Australia tax file number or keyword number exclusions. And we'll see what those look like in a second. Next thing is we have the same pattern, or we have a similar pattern, but with a higher confidence of 95. For this one, what we do is we actually make sure that we find the same regex, but we also want to have the Australian tax file number keywords be present in the proximity. And that kind of, again, gives us a higher confidence that we found the type of entity we're looking for. And you can obviously build these as much as you, and we're also checking for the exclusion of keyword number exclusions, which are specific values that seem to lead to false positives. So we've added those as exclusions through usage of min-match of zero. So the full schema of this and the various operators are fully documented on TechNet. I wanted to give you guys just a little bit of a feel of what these look like and some of the flexibility you have in terms of creating these. So any questions before? What we're going to do next is actually look at taking one of these and customizing it to add additional corroborative evidence that will match beyond what the definition is. So I'm going to take a built-in type and then extend it to have additional corroborative evidence. Yes?
Question. You said this is actually
available out of the box. Yes.
How do you actually get the XML?
So the question is, how do you actually get the XML for the built-in rule pack? Well, so if that's not documented, that's something we should get on there. But basically, you have to use PowerShell. Through PowerShell, you would obtain the classification rule pack. And the classification rule pack has a serialization operator on it. And if you serialize the rule pack, you will get this XML.
So the classification and the fingerprints
are different? No, so they're very similar. So the classification engine, the question was, are classifications and fingerprints different? And the answer is no, they're very much related. The classification engine understands both of these. What we're looking at here is more of defining entity-based matches. And if you're actually using the fingerprinting capabilities, the system will create and populate them in rule packs similar to this with the definition and a special operator that instructs the system, these are fingerprints, treat and evaluate them differently. Yes, correct. So that is very much, so the question is for the reporting of real-time reports, being able to configure that capability, is that optional? And that is very much true. That is, you have to explicitly add the action, and then you get to configure what appears in those reports, as you saw the two examples where one had more of the rule types and one had more of the content. One more question before we move on.
Yeah, can you show us what a keyword list looks like?
Yes, so that will coming right up. And the question was, what does a keyword list look like? All right, so what we're going to do is take our definition of... So this is Australian file tax number, and if I actually go ahead and look for this, especially keyword number exclusions, is located lower in a file. And here's actually, to answer your question, just a definition of keywords, and these are specific keywords that within that entity make sense to be excluded as lead to false positives. And what I'm going to do next is actually extend that set of exclusions to include additional keywords into the list and make them be part of the system of content that's detectable. So what I have done is I've created my own rule pack, which again is relatively simple. And again, more definitions of that are online. And if you guys have stuff about content from a documentation perspective that's missing, that's stuff we would definitely want to hear about, and make sure you send that feedback to us. So again, here we start off with defining who the publisher is, providing a little bit about the name and the description of the rule pack, and then get into the interesting area of customizing the Australian tax file number. So what I've done is I've actually copied this entity from the built-in one, the UB one, out of the box. And what I've done is basically have added my own capability to add additional set of exclusions. So from my testing, this seems to have been mapping into employee IDs. So I've decided to make sure I provide additional exclusions from that. And so basically what the rule looks like now is we have a confidence of 85, and we need to find the tax file number as our anchor. And then for the 85 capability, we want to make sure that nowhere in the proximity of the tax file number, we have any of these three keyword lists, and the new one being one I added myself. And for the other pattern of confidence 95, we're again having the same anchor, but in here we have one set of additional keywords we want to find in the proximity and still exclude three of these from the past. And if you want to see what these new things look like, it's just a keyword list defined in the file, and I've added Contoso employee ID and employee identification as the terms, because again, from my tuning, these were the terms that were sometimes causing false positives. So that will define and extend an existing type, and I'll show you how to bring that back into the system. Outside of this, I've also have created my own definition for an employee ID. Employees' IDs obviously aren't global, so it's not something that we're going to have. So my employee ID is a new entity. It's relatively simple. It has a regex pattern that marks the employee ID, and I've added additional keywords given just because it's a relatively simple regex pattern. The regex pattern here is around just 9 digits, so it's relatively trivial. So I've added a couple more terms to make sure that I have these in the proximity to reduce my false positives. And these two things are all I needed, I guess, plus the addition of some of the naming. So what I have added is just some resources that have, you know, what the name of this is and what is a description. So the name of our classification is IMMEC ID, and a description of what it is. And this, we've done the same for the customized Australian tax file number. So now, when you want to import these, you would actually first, I guess, import these into, you would do a get content command where you would read the content of the file and save that into a variable. And then you would actually, because I've imported this previously, I have to do a set classification rule collection commandlet and feed that data into the system. So obviously here I'm connecting to If I could only remember my password. Hopefully that will work. Otherwise, we'll... But here I'm just actually using PowerShell against my Office 365 tenant, and I'm executing the set classification collection commandlet to import the rule pack. If I was doing this for the first time, I would do a new rule pack commandlet to import it for the first time. So, and that's it. And what that means is now I've imported this new set of classifications into my system for usage. So let's see what that looks like. So if I go to my Japan financial data and go to my rules, what I'm going to start seeing is the fact that if I was to modify some of the classifications, I should be able to see IMMEC and a MEC customized tax file ID. And these appear in the same list as the ones that have been available out of the box. And this is kind of how the name and publisher start showing up in the system. And now I can add them into my transport rules and configure minimum, maximum counts just like any of the other ones. So here we're going to say minimum is 10, just to be consistent with the other rules. And this will configure the custom classification to now be available in the system. The system will actually push this out to both Outlook, OWA, or any of the endpoints where we're doing policy validation, so there's no other configuration you need to take advantage of the sensitive types you've defined. Any quick questions before we move on to the next? Yes. Good question. So fingerprints are coming right up, so please hold that question. No problem. One question in the back?
So will this apply for, like, link instant messages where people can also upload files?
So today our DLP capability focuses on mail as the workload. So we're specifically targeting Outlook, OWA, and Exchange. And we've also talked about in our previous conference, the SharePoint conference, on some of our DLP capabilities coming into SharePoint where we're integrated DLP with fast content detection. So right now we don't have a capability within Link to detect this. Yes?
How long does the push to the clients take?
So the question is, how long does the push to the clients take? So this now depends which client. For OWA, this is within, there's a cache limit of about 15 minutes, which those will be pushed to on the desktop client, the limit right now is a 24-hour cycle limit where the rules are cached on the client. There is an article on TechNet of how you can actually force the pushing of that by clearing a set of settings on the client system. So the question is, do the confidence levels sum? And no, you can think of them as being somewhat independent. So if we go back to our customized Australian tax file number example, you can see that each pattern definition has its own confidence. So then if you wanted to match on a customized Australian tax file number with confidence 95, you would actually go ahead and configure your rule here and select maximum, minimum, and maximum confidence levels to match the 95. So you can do a range, and if you wanted just to do that one, you would actually put 95 for both min and max to take advantage of that one. All right, so we're going to move on, and actually the next thing we're going to talk about is fingerprinting. All right, so document fingerprinting, it's a new capability released in SP1, and it's really focused, the scenario is really around document templates as we think about it. So think of the idea of, this is mostly applicable in organizations that use templates in their workloads, where you may have a template, for example, at Microsoft, we use common templates for engineering specs, or common templates for things like patent application. And then you would create a fingerprint of that template. And then basically, any place that template is used in the system, we would detect that there is a derivative work of the template. So there's really two parts to document fingerprinting. One is configuration. And the configuration is where you take the fingerprint data or the template, go ahead and generate a fingerprint to it, and then configure that fingerprint as something that matches in the policy rule. And that's kind of enables now detection of that fingerprint, very much like credit cards or any of the other entities we saw before. From a runtime perspective, what happens is as the messages flow through the system, we will generate the fingerprints of the messages and the attachments, and then compare how do those messages' fingerprints match with the fingerprints specified in our configuration. And that match is really based on the containment coefficient. And what that really means is we're looking for how much of the original template still remains in the file that's in the system. And that's kind of basically how fingerprinting works. I've included this slide for details of the algorithm. I won't actually walk through this, but if you're interested, you can pick up the title of this, do a Bing search on it, and you will find an article from Microsoft Research that will kind of give you a little bit more details of how that's done. So let's do a quick demo of fingerprinting. All right. So fingerprinting is actually located right in the same user interface, and fingerprinting creation is relatively straightforward. I already have three created here from documents. But basically, what you will do is you will select the name of the fingerprint, so say IP data. You will give some kind of description. And then select a file in the system that contains your fingerprinting templates. So here I have one, something called Contoso Patent Form. We'll open that up. It will generate the fingerprint, and you know you can add other content to this as well. So you can add other files, for example, medical form as well. This will generate a bunch of fingerprints and save them as IP data, and then make them available within sensitive types. So now if I go into Japan financial data, drill into my rules, go ahead and edit one of these rules that has sensitive data. My fingerprint will show up here. So there's IP data, the one I just created, and there's a couple of the other ones I had in the past. Just to show you what this looks like, so if I go to fingerprints, you know, the form was relatively straightforward. It was a blank form, similar to kind of what we've been using for patent applications. And then, you know, something that's a form that's filled in, these are the kind of things it would be targeted to match, where you're reusing a bulk of the form with additional content in the form. So that's kind of fingerprints and how they fit into the rest of the system. Once I've selected them from here and bound them to the transport rules, they're usable just like any of the other entities. All right, so moving along, I think we're pretty tight on time, so I wanted to show you one more thing, and that's specifically around customization of the end user education. So you've seen a number of demos around policy tips, which is our metaphor for education experience for the end users to get familiar with what the content is. Well, and being able to empower end users and bring them into the fold. Well, this is also an area that we provide customization. And customizations are actually at a couple different levels. One is you get to customize the actual messages that show up to the end users. And these are things like the policy tips, messages for notification, for overrides, and for blocks. Those are fully customizable. You get to also customize what is the URL where you want users to go in and find more information about your compliance policies. And also, you can customize the actual entities that are shown. And this is, again, tied into the custom classification name that you brought in and imported to the system. So let's quickly look at what that looks like. All right, so policy tips customization is, again, kind of straight in the middle of our DLP page. You can go in here, and you can see there's really three things you can configure. You can configure messages for notifying the sender, allowing them to override, and blocking the message. And then you get to select what locale for that message is. So you can actually define this for various locales that your organization supports. And then provide the text, and you're done. So if I look at one of these, I've added a notify sender message for one of my policies. And I've also modified a compliance URL, which is points to a different place. So let's see what that looks like from an end user perspective. So we're going to go ahead. We're going to be Sarah again. And we're going to create a new message. In this message, we're going to go to Jack again. And we're going to attach a file that's actually has employee IDs, which is the rule pack we imported in the past. And as you can see, this is our custom entity that was detected in the system. You can see the fact that we have a policy tip show up. The policy tip is customized. The message reads, "This message appears to contain sensitive information. Visit MEC 2014 to learn more about DLP." And you can go on the policy tips. The ID here is, again, picked up from the classification rules. And this is this IAM MEC ID. And you can click on Learn More, which in this case will actually go to link to my session. I should update my photo. But outside of that, this is a neat way to be able to customize. And we have flexibility of what these experiences are showcased to the end users. Any quick questions on that? So the question is, can we in the future, or is there plans, or can you do it today in terms of being able to provide a drop-down for the overrides? And I'm assuming this is so that the user doesn't have to type something. Sure. So you want to basically have pre-canned justification users can add. It's something that doesn't exist today. There is an option to have an override without providing any text for users that don't want to really provide much data. The one thing that we found, we've considered this in the past, is that if you provide these kind of options where the user really has little impact to it, we might as well provide them no option at all, because they'll just pick the first one that drops down. This is kind of why we have the option of no text. Sorry, any other question was? The string itself, I don't remember the exact characters, but there is a limit just because of the real estate space in Outlook and some of the applications. If you want to follow up, we can try to follow up on that. All right, so just... Anyway, so just wrapping things up. From extensibility points, we've covered most of these, but there's actually additional extensibility points beyond of what we've covered in this session. Specifically around incident reports, you can actually use those as an integration point into kicking off other workflows within incident management systems. So something that's, again, anything that has an SMTP, can receive SMTP content, can be integrated for the incident management mails to begin a more interesting workflow that's customized to your organization. Touch briefly about using custom agents on-prem to be able to leverage the detections we have from classification by us marking a header, and then your custom agent using that to do additional specialized processing. And then custom reporting solutions. We already have Dell, who has integrated DLP reporting for our capability into their message stats product. But fundamentally, because we're using the standard log from Exchange to put in the classification content, That's available to anyone to extend and integrate with their system. Anyway, so that's kind of my quick whirlwind of customization areas and more deep dive on our DLP capabilities. If you have any more questions, please let it come up now, or there's also the follow-up session of just Unplugged, where you can come with those questions as well. Because I just think we're running a little bit out of room. So any questions? Sorry, in back.
So does this work on a hybrid environment? Like if you have these DLP customizations, will this only work for Office 365, or do I have to configure like the equivalent in my on-premise?
So it will work in both, but you do have to configure it independently today. So you would have to configure it. The same capability exists for both on-prem and in the cloud, but you would actually have to reconfigure some of the aspects of the system. Now, you can obviously export your customized rules between the two environments, but they're not synchronized automatically today between the hybrid environments.
Okay. And then just to follow up, so for these DLP rules, will this work on ActiveSync devices, email via ActiveSync devices?
So not today. The transport rules are themselves applied in the categorizer in transport, and that's so your messages have to be going through that pipeline for that to be hit today. Sorry, would you mind using the mic?
Applied to the transport layer. So even if the client is not supportive, for an example, earlier version of Outlook or ActiveSync,
yes,
the policies still get applied?
Correct.
Right?
Correct. The policies still get applied. You won't get the rich client interaction,
right,
but the policies on the server are definitely evaluated, and that's why we have the integration of the two layers to provide a consistent policy application in the system.
Thank you. And one thing that maybe you know it better, I don't remember the exact word, some of the third-party encryption providers, for an example, Zix, they have been doing this work for several years, and they have already developed this huge classification type or words type in past, right? And as a basis, it comes with a default setting, and you configure it, and based on that knowledge that they have gathered over past several years, it encrypts the email accordingly. Can we have something similar here down the road in Exchange?
Sure, we'll definitely be considering those kind of capabilities.
It's a huge advantage. Yep. I mean, I use it all the time. You don't have any configuration after that because it's time tested.
Sure, and so this is our policy templates is a start in that direction in terms of being able to get in built-in types from the past. So it looks like we're losing the room, so I'll be here on the side and I'll take questions. But thank you very much.
Excuse me, I have one question. When the